For the 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Many thanks for joining us. Coming up, thousands protesting Saturday's bombing in Turkey's capital.
We will not meet this violence with violence. We are committed to holding all those to account.
Also ahead, fraud claimed in Guinea's election, plus a new documentary exploring the life of Malala Yousafzai. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Turkey has started 3 days of official mourning following Saturday's twin bombings at a peace rally in the capital, Ankara, that left at least 95 people dead. But appeals for unity are giving way to increasing bitter recriminations. Dorian Jones reporting now from Istanbul.
Thousands of protesters chant Sunday in the capital, Ankara, saying the state and government will be held to account. Mourning is fast giving way to anger in the aftermath of Turkey's worst terrorist attack. Some organisers of Saturday's peace rally claim there was little security, even though there had been increasing fears of a possible attack. Interior Minister Salami Altunok has denied negligence. The leader of the pro-Kurdish Peace and Democracy Party, Selahattin Demirtas, has accused the government and security forces of collusion in the bombings. Addressing Sunday's Ankara protests, he said he's committed to finding the truth.
Devlet bizim malımız, ülke bizim malımız diyenler, halka hesap vereceksiniz.
He said we will not meet this violence with violence, but he says we are committed to holding all those to account. Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu has condemned accusations of government collusion and is accusing the Kurdish leader of inflammatory comments. It's the third fatal bombing aimed at pro-Kurdish groups since June. In July, 33 young activists were killed by a suicide bomber. The previous attacks were blamed by security forces on Islamic State militants. But in what observers say was a controversial move, the government refused to open a parliamentary investigation into the bombings. Saturday's double bombing is adding to a deepening polarization of the country as it heads to a general election in November. Destabilizing the elections is seen as a possible motive behind Saturday's attack. The fear in Turkey now is, what else can happen before Election Day? Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
And in other news, Iran says a verdict has been issued in the trial of Washington Post reporter Jason Rezaian, a dual U.S.-Iranian citizen who was arrested 15 months ago on espionage and other charges. There were no details on what the verdict is, but a judiciary spokesman said it can be appealed. Rezaian had been working for the Washington Post in Iran since 2012 before he was arrested in July of 2014 together with his wife and two other people. They've been released, but Rezaian remained in jail. Because the verdict is not clear, International Edition's Jim Stevenson asks VOA Persian Service television producer Human Bakhter, what does the announcement of a verdict mean?
For non-Iranians, the trial process, in fact, the Iranian judiciary system is very, very opaque. Even Iranians have a hard time understanding what goes on behind the closed doors because nothing is transparent. And there's no due process evidence. There's no discovery process where the prosecutor has to give all the evidence presented to the defense. So it's very arbitrary, basically. And so people now are speculating as to why Jason Rezaian was arrested 450 days ago on purely trumped-up charges. Mm-hmm. And I think for Iranians, this is how Iranian officials have always operated since they came to power in 1979. It's always they've used these tactics, blackmail and hostage taking as a means, as a diplomatic means to advance their goals. And so, like in 1979, they stormed the embassy and took those hostages in order to have the Shah of Iran extradited, who was having medical treatment here in the United States. And now, the speculation has been that Jason Rezaian was taken as a hostage last year in order to secure the release of a number of Iranian citizens who were imprisoned for circumventing U.S. sanctions against Iran and breaking U.S. laws.
Because we don't really understand what this verdict means at this point in time, do we have a sense that we will know fairly soon? How does that process play out?
Well, once the verdict is issued, whether it's sentencing or it's acquittal, we should know within the next few days. My sense is that he's going to be sentenced to a year or two or 3 years or how many years, I don't know, but that he will be given clemency by the Supreme Leader. That has been the pattern in the past. As I said, there's absolutely no proof, there's no shred of proof that he was any kind of a spy. The only thing that they could find against him was that they searched his web history, and it turned out that in 2009, after the election of President-elect Obama, he went to the website and that was set up before he was inaugurated, looking for work, basically, as an Iranian-American, and he applied for some kind of job or in the transition period. So that's the only thing they could find. But there's absolutely no shred of evidence that he was actively involved in espionage.
A VOA Persian Service TV producer, Human Bakhtir, speaking with my colleague, Jim Stevenson. And now let's check in with International Edition's G. Abby Lee about what's trending online about the resigned verdict. G, I guess to the Twitter world, it's just about as unclear as it is to everyone else trying to figure out the verdict. And I'm sure the media outlets are all over Twitter on this one.
Hi, Steve. While the situation is still unclear, many media outlets are tweeting the final verdict is out, but no one seems to know what it is exactly. The New York Times tweeted a link to an article that reported the final verdict is unknown to even his lawyer or family members. Many accounts are also sharing links to analytical pieces on the latest development. So here's what The Economist tweeted. Washington Post journalist Jason Rezaian sentenced in Iran. He's a pawn in a larger game.
Yeah, that seems to be the case. Can you elaborate for our listeners?
Sure. So the article argues many in Tehran think the case is less about a spying allegation than about the Iran nuclear talks. And that's really unfortunate because it seems like Rezaian had so much pride in his Persian heritage, but he's being punished for it instead.
He is. Is he on Twitter?
Yes, but he hasn't been on it for more than a year for obvious reasons. The handle is @JRezaian, that's R-E-Z-A-I-A-N, and his last tweet is from July 21st last year, which is a day before he and his wife were taken into custody.
And what about other news coming out of Iran?
Oh gosh, where do I begin? So, on the same day, Iran tested a long-range missile, which could be in violation of a nuclear deal signed with the U.S. and other Western countries. The CEO of the Foreign Policy Group, which owns the news publication Foreign Policy and the website, sent out a sarcastic tweet. David Rothkopf is on Twitter at DJ Rothkopf, that's R-O-T-H-K-O-P-F-T, and he tweeted, "Starting to think the Obama doctrine is about it's a thought that counts." Texas Senator John Cornyn also tweeted, "That didn't take long," before sharing a link to the same NYT article Rothkopf tweeted. Steve, back to you.
And many thanks to you, G. That's International Edition's G. Abby Lee. If you'd like to follow G on Twitter, her handle is @GAbbyLee. And you can also follow International Edition, our handle, at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at #VOA. You can reach me at Twitter @PerryCal. or talk to the show anytime, please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time,
with David Bandy.
This is VOA's International Edition. Top Syrian rebel commander says he thinks the recent rebel successes on the battlefield there could lead to an escalation in Russian military intervention in Syria. We get more now from Jamie Detmer on the ground in the region.
General Salim Idris is a man divided. He's jubilant at the successes Free Syrian Army rebels have notched against President Bashar al-Assad, whose forces launched ground offensives with support from Russian warplanes. The biggest Syrian government offensive is near Hama.
The regime lost more than 20 tanks, lost a lot of soldiers and officers and vehicles. On the coastal front, they shot down 3 helicopters. It is a very good success.
The general, who defected from the Syrian army early in the civil conflict in 2012, says his biggest worry is that Moscow will do more on the ground and send in its own soldiers. He says at the moment the only Russians on the front lines are officers and advisers, but he says he fears that the setbacks Syrian government forces have suffered the past few days will change that.
Now everything is to be expected. Maybe they will send troops to fight with the regime, because, as you know, the airstrikes cannot control the territory. And the last 2 days gave them a very important lesson.
Idris says he fears that now that the Russians are intervening, the West will reduce its overall support of the Syrian revolution, not wanting to become embroiled in a Cold War-style proxy war.
I expect maybe the support will be less and less. And I told the commanders yesterday, they have to think that at some day they will not receive any support.
The future of the revolution can only be decided, the general says, by those fighting on the ground. Jamie Detmer for VOA News, Gaziantep, Turkey.
And for some perspective on the Russian involvement in Syria, VOA's Anis Ahmed speaks with Ali Riaz. He's a professor and chairman of the Department of Politics and Government at Illinois State University. Asked him about Moscow's objectives in Syria.
President Vladimir Putin has made it very clear that his primary objective is to keep Assad in power, because he feels that Bashar al-Assad is the legitimate government. This is the primary objective. Is there a secondary objective to it? Of course there is a secondary objective to it. It is if they can, you know, eliminate, if not eliminate, weaken ISIS, because ISIS is also a threat to the Assad regime. And, of course, for the international legitimacy, they will have to fight against the ISIS regime. And they have their intention, they have their reason to fight ISIS, because ISIS is a threat not only to Syria and Iraq at this moment, potentially it can become a threat to Russia in future, especially in Central Asia and a few other places. So I think it is primarily at this point to save the Assad regime from the problem, the situation the Assad regime has put in over the last 4 years.
In spite of Russia's support for the rebels in eastern Ukraine and the annexation of Crimea, EU to a large extent has remained indifferent. Do you think this has emboldened Russia to expand its influence in the Middle East?
To a certain extent you can say that one, but at the same time it is not only the indifference of the NATO partner or the European allies that has caused this situation. Russian game plan has always been to exert itself in the Middle East, and Middle East has become the battleground in many ways. And particularly, you have to look into the Syrian situation, because in Syria, there are two bases, particularly the Tartus base. It's a deep sea port, and the Russian presence has been there since 1971. And in 2005, there was a huge deal because the Syrians had a large amount of debt. Russia gave up, you know, write off 70% of it in exchange of the contract to continue. So the Russians' interest in terms of the Middle East and particularly Syria is Tartus is one, Latakia is the other one. So they wanted to have influence in the Middle East. So whether, you know, you were indifferent or not, at some point Russia would have tried to exert itself. And in the Middle East game, if you call it a game, power game, the Russians have interest. They need to be on the table. In some ways, they want to be a partner, and that is how they're inserting themselves into this partnership.
Iraq, Syria, and Iran are said to have reached an understanding with Russia to exchange information on the ISIS or ISIL. Some news even say that Iraq has looked at Russia's military intervention in a more positive way. Do you think it may redefine U.S.-Iraq relationship?
I don't think that in the long run or in the medium term it is going to have some sort of a problem with the Iraq-U.S. relationship. There is no quick fix to it. And as we speak, if you look at what is happening in Syria, Aleppo, for example, it is now has become a situation where, despite this Russian bombing, the ISIS fighters are making progress, which is very unfortunate. Now, if a cooperation, even United States included in that, emerges in regard to information exchange and a global alliance against the ISIS, that's fine, that's far better. But I'm afraid that at this point, given the Russians' primary objective is to save Assad regime, they would like to put it in a situation, leave only one opponent in this multi-sided war. Either you choose Assad or you choose ISIS. If that is the situation they are putting the world into, that would be the unfortunate part. And the second thing is, it is not, there is no quick fix to it. More importantly, I'm afraid whether Russians are getting into a long-term Afghanistan kind of situation.
Ali Riaz, professor, chairman of the Department of Politics and Government at Illinois State University. He was speaking with VOA's Anis Ahmed. Voters in Guinea went to the polls on Sunday. They were doing their best to elect a president, and the country's opposition candidates are saying the vote was rigged. We get more now from Chris Stein in the capital, Conakry.
Polling in Guinea's presidential election ended Sunday evening. Voters were choosing between giving President Alpha Conde a second term or replacing him with one of seven opposition challengers. While looting and clashes between rival political supporters erupted in Guinea earlier in the week, there was no sign of trouble in Conakry as the polls opened. The head of the African Union delegation monitoring the vote, Delaita Mohamed Delaita, called voting peaceful. He says that based on what he saw today, the elections took place under very good conditions. Guinea's opposition parties decried the election as fraudulent. Saturday evening, leading opposition candidate Selu Daline Diallo told VOA he had no confidence in the Electoral Commission. He said he and six other opposition challengers would reject the polls if they believed they were rigged. In Conakry's Kaloum neighborhood, some polling stations had closed by the 6 p.m. cutoff time, but others were still filled with voters waiting to cast their ballots. Fode Sanu, the presiding officer of one of the polling stations where voting was still ongoing, said he had to extend voting hours by 90 minutes because of issues with the voter list. This list wasn't in alphabetical order, he says. So in order to find a voter, we had to go name by name through the list. That's what caused the backup. Preliminary results are expected later in the week. Chris Stein for VOA News, Conakry, Guinea.
And in U.S. politics, billionaire real estate mogul Donald Trump continues to lead the crowded field of Republican presidential candidates, while Hillary Clinton is the top Democrat. A newly released poll of 1,200 voters by CBS News gives Trump 27% support among Republicans. He's followed by another political novice, former neurosurgeon Bing Carson, with 21%. None of the other 13 Republican candidates gets double-digit support. For the Democrats, the CBS poll shows Clinton far out in front with 46%, followed by Senator Bernie Sanders with 27%, and Vice President Joe Biden, who has yet to declare his candidacy, having 16%. For more on the U.S. presidential race and the rest of the day's news, you can check out our website. We're at voanews.com. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Recently, the science world was all a Twitter after NASA announced that its scientists found evidence of flowing water on Mars. The excitement raised the hopes of many that life might exist on the red planet. Researchers at Caltech studied data from NASA's Curiosity rover and are now saying that they have found evidence of lakes and streams on ancient Mars. They say 3.8 billion to 3.3 billion years ago, the red planet had a much more rich and robust atmosphere and a lively hydrosphere where water flowed and accumulated in lakes across its surface. The evidence suggesting a watery ancient Mars was found in sediment layers near the base of Mount Sharp, a 4.5 kilometer mountain rising from the center of the massive Gale Crater. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Davis Guggenheim's documentary, He Named Me Malala, offers a probing look into the life of 18-year-old Malala Yousafzai. She's the Pakistani teenager who in 2012 was shot in the head by the Taliban for standing up for her rights for education in her hometown in Pakistan's Swat Valley. Well, Guggenheim shows how since then Malala has become a symbol of not so much a victim of brutal violence, but as an advocate for girls' education throughout the world. We get more now from VOA's Penelope Pulu.
There is a moment when you have to choose whether to be silent or to stand up.
On October 9, 2012, Malala Yousafzai was shot in the head by the Taliban on her way home from school in Pakistan. Her crime? She believed in her right to education at a time when the Taliban was bombing schools in the Swat Valley. Her wounds were critical. But Malala Yousafzai survived stronger than ever.
They shot me on the left side of my head. They thought that the bullet would silence us. I am the same Malala.
To understand Malala's personality and inner power, Davis Guggenheim explores her family dynamics, especially her bond with her dad.
When she was very small, many friends used to come to our home. We used to talk about politics, we used to talk about the basic rights, and she used to sit with us.
When I was younger, I used to listen to him. Like, what is he saying, how he talks?
Davis Guggenheim says that Malala's life was almost prescribed from the moment her father, himself an activist, named her after a 19th century Afghan folk heroine.
She was inspired by the girl she was named after, the Malala of Mewand, that girl who spoke out for what she believed. And rallied the Afghan troops to defeat the British.
The film also shows that after Malala was shot, her father was devastated because he felt responsible for raising her with ideas that endangered her life. But Malala thinks otherwise.
My father only gave me the name Malala. He didn't make me Malala.
Still, the film raises the question, what formed Malala into the person she is today?
I chose this life.
Who would you have been if you were just an ordinary girl from the Swat Valley?
If I was an ordinary girl in Swat Valley, I'm still an ordinary girl. But if I had an ordinary father and an ordinary mother and a family, a conservative family, then I would have two children now.
After a slow and painful recovery, Malala made it her goal to rally for girls' education the world over. Guggenheim describes her as fearless.
Malala, you know, speaks to world leaders. We were in Nigeria when the girls had been kidnapped for a long period of time, and she insisted to sit down with President Goodluck Jonathan and said, "What are you doing about these girls? It's your job to get them released." She met President Obama and asked him about drone strikes.
Nobel Peace Prize is to be awarded to Malala Yousafzai.
That fearlessness and her message brought her the Nobel Peace Prize in 2014.
She has something to teach the world, not just because she was a girl who was shot on the school bus, not just because of her advocacy work, but because she has a very, very deep soul. She's a very spiritual person, and I think she has a strong voice that speaks to a lot of people who are voiceless.
I tell my story not because it is unique. It is the story of many girls. We realize the importance of light when we see darkness, the importance of our voice when we are silenced. Let us pick up our books and our pens. They are our most powerful weapons.
Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
Amazing story, Malala. That's a documentary I'd like to see. One other item for you here before we say goodbye. Spotify has released U.S. First Lady Michelle Obama's music playlist, including tunes by Beyonce, Demi Lovato, Esperanza Spalding, all as she celebrates the International Day of the Girl. Annual day is designated by the UN to promote awareness for gender equality, inequality around the world. Mrs. Obama's playlist, we're told, also includes pop stars like Alicia Keys, Jessie J, Ariana Grande, and Nicki Minaj. Mrs. Obama promoting the Let's Girls Learn campaign to encourage girls' education around the world. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. A reminder, the top world news is straight ahead. Hope you'll stay tuned. And for our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jim Harmon, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In addition to ISIL's atrocities inflicted every day on the Iraqi and Syrian people living in communities the terrorist group has seized, the crucifixions, beheadings, sexual enslavement and violence, rape and denial of every human right, ISIL is also engaged in other crimes, including its attempt to erase cultural heritage that does not conform to its narrow ideology. ISIL's latest reported cultural destruction target is the Arch of Triumph in the ancient Syrian city of Palmyra, a monument thought to be 2,000 years old. It is now added to the list of ISIL's demolition of shrines or statues that predate the founding of Islam, like the Assyrian winged bulls in Nineveh, the historic lions in Raqqa, and the tomb of Jonah in Mosul. What ISIL doesn't destroy of Syria and Iraq's ancient history and heritage, it sells, Deputy Secretary of State Antony Blinken noted recently at a symposium at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City.
These ancient coins, stone, glass, mosaic fragments, travel organized routes through black markets in the Middle East, Europe, and the Persian Gulf. The profits return to line the pockets of these extremists, funding more savagery, more terror, and more devastation.
It is for this reason the United States has developed red lists with the International Council of Museums to help law enforcement officials recognize looted objects. It's why the U.S. has stepped up efforts through the Global Coalition to Counter ISIL to encourage greater action against the illicit trade. It's why the United States works so closely with international law enforcement agencies in the U.S. and around the world. And it's why the United States recently announced that it is offering, through the State Department's Rewards for Justice program, up to $5 million for information leading to the significant disruption of the sale and or the trade of antiquities by, for, or on behalf of ISIL. Calling the refusal to deal in conflict antiquities both a legal and moral obligation, Mr. Blinken said, in the face of the urgent challenges of today, it is critical that we hold fast to the fabric of our humanity, to our gifts of reason and wisdom, our expressions of art and culture, and our universal values of civility, freedom, and dignity. These are exactly what ISIL seeks to destroy.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
is